Wild courage exists to galvanize a generation of men. The tools and courage to fight for what matters most. And tell the stories that are born in the redemption of lives and souls.
Hey guys, welcome back to the Wild Courage Podcast. Today, I'm in the barn in Emmett with my friend Matt Zupanek. How's it going, buddy?
Better than I deserve.
How are you today? I'm doing great. It's a beautiful spring Sunday afternoon, and you just happen to be traveling through. And you and I have been talking about maybe getting you on the podcast at some point, and it just worked out perfect as you were traveling through. So thanks for taking a little detour over to Emmett.
Oh, you bet. Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so we met through Grant, right? Grant Gallagher is how we met. Grant started a fire in Pavilion, a Wild Courage fire, and I came over to hang out and meet all the guys that have been going to their fire, and that's the first time I met you.
Yes, sir.
And you live in Pavilion, Wyoming, right?
Riverton.
Riverton. So it's close to Pavilion, though, where Grant lives.
Like halfway between the two.
Yeah.
Where our little place is.
Yeah. And so we got to know each other there a little bit. And then about a year ago, we had our spring retreat in Jackson Hole. And you came to our retreat. And that's when we kind of got to hang out a little bit more.
Yes, sir.
I wasn't in your group. So I didn't get to know your story or really get to know you too well, because we all kind of hang out in our three-man groups with our guys that we're with. But you have one of the most incredible stories, the little bit I know of it, of anyone I've ever had, not alone just had on the podcast, but I've ever met. So this is what's fun for me, is I get to know more about you as we sit here and kind of talk about this. Are you from Wyoming?
Yes, sir. I was born at Colorado, but I lived in LaBarge, Wyoming my entire life.
Oh, you did?
Growing up.
Do you have siblings?
I had one sister that I grew up with, and then after my parents divorced, my father remarried, and his wife had two girls and a boy.
So you have, they had them together, so you have...
No, they didn't have them together. They were separate. She had them from her previous marriage as well.
So you just have the one sister?
Yeah. Just the one.
Yep. What was growing up in LaBarge, Wyoming, like? For most people who've never heard of LaBarge, it's a very small town in kind of southwestern Wyoming, right?
Yeah, LaBarge is 100 miles to the nearest Walmart.
Oh, dang.
One direction.
Where is that? Where do you have to go?
Rock Springs.
Rock Springs is 100 miles.
98 miles from LaBarge, yes, sir.
Yeah, and what'd your dad do there?
Oh, my father always worked on drilling rigs.
Oh, he did?
And he never was really around too much.
Because he was always working?
And if he was in town, he was across the alley at the location bar.
Oh, yeah. That's what he did when he was home?
Yeah. Or he was down the street at the Eagle, one of them. There's three of them to choose from.
That's where you knew you could find him?
Yeah.
So would he work hitches then? Would he be gone like for 2 weeks and then home for 2 weeks, or?
Yeah. He worked for True Drilling, and they worked a lot, 8-hour towers and no days off. So he was all over the place.
So he'd be gone for months at a time?
Months at a time.
Oh, I see.
Then he worked in Honduras.
In the oil field?
Yeah. And he'd be gone down there for 28 days at a time, and then back for 28 days.
What was it like when he was home?
Oh, it wasn't too bad. He was, because then, about the time I started remembering, well, we were having fun, and he was making lots of money or whatever, so we had motorcycles to ride, or we'd go hunting and go camp and whatever, and just have a good time, you know, and... Like, he'd do that all day, and then he'd go hang out with his friends and go to the bar all night, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah. How was that? That was probably pretty hard for your mom.
Well, they didn't get, they didn't stay married, but a handful of years. And I guess before my ninth birthday, they got divorced and he'd moved on.
Oh, really? He left LaBarge?
Yeah, he went to Montana, to Boulder, Montana.
So it was just you and your mom and your sister, and you guys stayed in LaBarge?
Yeah, and my mom became friends with these people, and she had some horses up there or whatever, and they ended up getting married together, and they're still married today, and my stepdad, he's 84 years old.
Oh, wow. And he introduced you to horses then?
Yeah, he lived his whole life in LaBarge.
Wow.
Never lived anywhere else.
So what did he do?
He worked on ranches growing up, and then he graduated and went to work in the oil field. And when he quit, he was the production foreman of the Fontenelle field over there. It's owned by Exxon and XTO, and Exxon bought them out now. And
yep. So when your folks got divorced, you were 9, you said?
Yeah. I was 9, and then my parents, when my stepmother and father got remarried. My mother and my stepfather got married when I was 9.
Okay. How old were you when your mom and dad got divorced?
Well, probably a couple years before that, year and a half.
So you remember?
Yeah, I remember.
Because you were 7-ish.
Yeah, I remember a bunch of the battles and I remember a bunch of the drinking and the partying that went on at our house, and I don't know, it was second nature, I guess.
Yeah. That's a tough way to grow up. But when it's the only thing you know, you don't know any different. You just kind of, that's life, right?
Mm-hmm.
When your dad moved to Boulder, you probably had different emotions. Were you sad or were you glad?
Both, I'd say, maybe. I suppose I was glad because I didn't have to worry about that anymore, but I think I held a huge resentment toward my mother for making him leave, and him as well for leaving me high and dry.
Yeah. Yeah, that's about the time my folks got divorced. I was a little bit younger, but yeah, it's very confusing, all those emotions, because we don't know what they really mean. We just know that we don't feel good inside when our family's not together, even if it was bad, right? Which it sounded like their marriage probably had some problems if your dad spent most of the time at the pub.
Yeah, it was pretty rough on my mom for sure. And well, she went a couple of years working two jobs and whatever. She was a manager of this restaurant and been a cook my whole life, I guess. And so I was always, I wasn't very tall. I was always short and fat and real unathletic.
Oh, yeah. Sports wasn't your jam growing up.
I was short, fat, and slow.
Your trifecta.
Yeah.
What was your relationship with your little sister? Did you feel like protective of her? And
was 6 years older than I was.
Oh, she was older.
So I wanted to be a bully and thought I was tough or whatever, and she'd always beat me up.
Smack you around.
I'd try karate on her, and she'd smack me down. And
that didn't pan out very well for you.
She was way tougher than I was.
By the time you were in junior high, did she move away?
Yeah, she moved away and went to beauty school and wound up in Oklahoma.
Oh, wow. So when you were 9, your mom gets remarried and your stepdad had kids. Were they in the house or were they?
My stepdad had one kid and he was much older than us.
So he wasn't in the house?
No, he'd done moved out and was working in LaBarge and living in LaBarge too. And he still lives in LaBarge now. He actually neighbors with my parents. He built the house up on the hill, like right next to him. And he has two girls.
He
works for the county down there now.
And, oh, nice. So were you ever close with him, your stepbrother?
Oh, yeah. We'd go hunting and stuff. And we, y'all think, always go hang out up on the mountain. And I used to go down and hang out at his house, especially I go to my brother's house and I could drink or do whatever I was wanting to do. And
not get in trouble.
Play with the big play with the big boys, you know?
Yeah.
Well, it's okay. My mom never worried about it because I was just at my brother's house.
Yeah. So you could do whatever you needed to do.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool to have.
I could get out of control without getting in trouble too much because he was somewhat watching over me, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Even though we were doing things that we shouldn't have been doing.
Yeah. What was your relationship like with your stepdad?
Oh, it was good. But at the same time, it was a little bit tough because he was so much older than I was. He was in his 50s when I, you know, late 40s, early 50s when they got together.
Yeah, and you're just a little boy.
Or late 40s, early 50s. Yeah, that's what I said.
Yeah.
And I was just young, and he taught me a lot of stuff, but at the same time, he'd already raised his kid to adulthood. And now he's got a 10-year-old little boy that...
It's a lot.
He accepted or whatever and brought in, and I don't know. I kind of felt like sometimes he was too old to do that stuff.
Yeah. When your dad moved to Montana, did you ever go see him in the summers or anything?
Yes. I'd go up there and see him in the summers, and it was all fun and games. You know, it was all fun and games. And you'd go up there and hang out, and he had a boat. He was making that big oil field money. You know, he was roughneck rich.
Roughneck rich. Yeah. That's a good way to put it. I met a lot of those guys in my life, too.
Yeah. But so he had a boat. We'd go to the lake all the time, and we had motorcycles. We'd go ride motorcycles, and he was still doing the partying deal, though. Him and my stepmother, they like to go do a bunch of partying and stuff. And I know there was three of them kids and me, so there'd be five kids and the adults. And if my sister came up too, there'd be six kids. So a lot of times going back and forth to the lake, me and my stepbrother Dave, we'd ride in the back of the truck. After they'd been drinking out at the lake all day long, we'd crawl on the back and ride all the way back from 40, 50, 60 miles in the back of the pickup.
Yeah, you can't do that these days. So you had good memories of summertime with Dad.
Yeah, they were good.
Yeah.
There were a few bad ones too. Things got out of control a few times on both directions. I'm there, no doubt.
Like you just kind of acting out and stuff?
Oh, yeah.
What kind of kid were you?
I wasn't a very nice kid. I was a bully. Because I was short, fat, and slow. And the only thing I could do was bully people around, I guess, for the most part.
What was high school like for you? Had you gotten into horses at that point?
Oh, not too much. I started working on that ranch. Like we was talking earlier about going from the barge to Alpine through the mountains. And he had a permit. He had a little place of his own. He ran 500 cows on. And then he was the boss for this other place that was the part of the same ranch that he owned. It's part of his wife's family's ranch, but they went broke in the 80s, and he was able to keep part of it for himself, and then he was able to be the overseer of the rest of it.
Oh, nice.
So it's like he had the same job, just
he didn't know
half of it was owned by this other man, and the other half he was working to own himself.
What? And he kind of took you under his wing as a green kid that didn't, like, know a whole lot about horses?
Didn't know nothing.
Did he teach you stuff or just kick you out?
A lot of times. He taught me so much stuff. And he had three boys that was just a little younger than my sister. So they was like between my sister's age and myself. So they was like older brothers for me, I guess.
Oh, nice.
And they've whipped me into shape and
taught you things.
Make me walk home and go home crying sometimes.
Initiation.
Oh, yeah.
Did the horse thing, like, catch on at that time in your life? Were you like, oh, this is what I want to do?
All I wanted to do was be a cowboy from then on. And I got sucked into the oil field.
Oh, you did? After high school?
Yeah, I went to work for my real dad, and on the drilling rigs when I was 18, and I went to shoeing school just before that at 17 because I got kicked out of high school. Because school wasn't very important to me at all. I worked for that ranch in the summertime. And so come school time, well, that was the time to go catch up and hang out with my buddies.
Yeah, you hadn't seen them all summer.
You didn't know all the wild stuff that I'd missed out on. And I didn't pay any attention to school. Like, I couldn't catch on to a bunch of the stuff, it didn't matter to me. I wouldn't do it.
So they asked you to leave?
And they told me I was no longer welcome to come back to Big Piney High School.
How old were you then?
17.
That was it. So where'd you go to shoeing school?
Ardmore, Oklahoma.
Oh, yeah. How was that?
Oh, that was a good time down there.
Learned a bunch?
Oh, yeah. And I had me one of them fake IDs, and we'd go down there to them.
Well, they had good all music.
All them dance halls they got down there around, like, Davis, Ardmore. There's a couple more, and then we'd venture down to Fort Worth a couple of times, down to the Billy Bob's, and that was a pretty good time, pretty wild.
Did you take the shoeing school kind of serious, though, too?
I took the shoeing school serious, I guess, because I wanted to do something. It had my interest.
Yeah.
And I already had a little knowledge of shoeing horses before then, because that man I worked for, he'd shoe my horses I rode. And then after a while, when I got a little older, he walked by me one day and he threw the tools down. He says, "You've watched long enough. Now you get to do your own."
That was it?
Yeah. And of course, it was the revolving best horse I ever. Just stand there and try to kick your head off when you went to shoe him. So I learned how to shoe my own for the first time with him tied up. And when I got out of shoeing school, I had that knowledge, I guess. So I took all the bad ones. He's a bad one. Nobody can push it on him. Well, I'll do it. I can do it. I guarantee I can do it.
Yeah.
Whether I have to tie him down and do him laying down. I don't mind doing them when they're laying down, I'd say.
Yeah, you kind of get used to it when they've got a hay bale between their legs and tied down.
And but then I got new, when I got out of shoeing school, I shod horses all summer long, and then I got 18 years old that winter.
Then you could go to the oil rig.
And I went to work on the drilling rigs.
Just roughnecking?
Yeah, working floors for $15.44 an hour. Boy, I was making big
crushing money. It, right?
More money than I'd ever seen in my life. Now I can see why my father had all that fancy boats and motorcycles and stuff like that. New pickups.
Where were you living when you were working in the oil patch? Where did you go home to on your days off?
Oh, well, we was working for true. We was working 21 on, 7 off. So I just had an apartment right there in Big Piney. We was working on the mesa there by kind of between Big Piney, Boulder, and Pinedale. I think they call it the Pinedale Anticline or something.
Mm-hmm. What would you do with all your money?
Well, I'd get drunk and do drugs and chase girls, and all the rest I'd waste on bills.
Did you do the whole shiny pickup and all those things?
Every bit of it. Brand new pickups, new snowmobiles.
All the toys.
Oh, yeah.
All the things that are supposed to make you happy, right?
Yeah, and I was happy to have them. I enjoyed them and I had fun.
What kind of, on the rigs back then, they didn't drug test or anything, right?
No, sir. So I wouldn't have been working. I would have been working somewhere else.
Yeah, you'd have been cowboying.
I'd have been doing something else.
Yeah. What kind of drugs were you into?
Oh, mostly crystal meth and marijuana, and alcohol was probably the worst one of them all.
Yeah. But that's just part of that culture too, right?
And I don't know, I guess I'd think of the story like, if they could do something, somebody could do something, well, I could do it better. And I'd have a better story to tell at the end of it than they could. So I don't know. it got me into a lot of trouble. And I had a bully growing up, and the difference was is if somebody wanted to fight back, I was good with that too. If you want to fight back, if you don't want to just let me be the bully and give in, we'll go ahead and fight about it too. I didn't have any qualms about that. Like, I guess it didn't hurt my feelings to kick somebody in the face. And I don't like doing that, but I'm glad those days are gone.
Yeah.
I'll tell you for sure.
So you'd go work and then have 7 days off, and it was just a free for all. Cause back then, I mean, I've got friends that are roughnecks from back in the day, and they're like, no, we did drugs while we were working on the rigs too. We didn't just do it when we were on days off. Was that your story too?
Yeah, pretty much. I got high to go to work every day, and I'd go to work so I could get high every day.
Yeah, they kind of go hand in hand.
Yeah. They just feed off one off the other. And
how long did you do that? How long did you work on the rigs? Were you getting in trouble, like, legally ever? Like, in these little tiny Wyoming towns with the law or anything?
No.
Just getting a fist fight and then...
Then I'd take off and go back to... Usually we down in Rock Springs where the strip clubs was, you know, go down to them shaker clubs down in Rock Springs and Green River. Get cross-threaded in there and then jump in the truck and take off for the barge.
Retreat.
Yeah. Hide out in our little one-horse town.
Yep. Wait for the smoke to clear and then go back in the next days off.
And go hit the rigs. Whatever. Get another paycheck. Go back down. Go into the place. And if they seen you, you'd be like, oh, I'm so sorry. And just really eat that humble pie, you know.
Yeah. I didn't mean to do that.
Oh, I'm sorry. I know that this is your establishment and it won't happen again. And then a couple times later, it happens again. And
so how many years or how long did you work in the oil patch?
About 8 years.
Oh, so, wow. So all through your, mostly through your 20s, you were, that was the cycle.
Yeah. Get off tower sometimes in Pinedale. And our guy was right down kind of on the border there. And we'd go down there, make a little run through there, and then come back and be back to work for the next shift.
Oh, to go get your drugs?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, that's such a part of that culture from the old school guys that I worked with in the Bakken in the oil patch, which you can't get away with that now because they drug test everybody, you know. And
now they pull your hairs out.
Yeah. But I heard lots of stories. My buddy Sam Phillips would tell me crazy stories about back in the day in the oil patch. So 8 years. So any consistent like girlfriend or anything in that time period, or were you just living your wild life?
Just living my wild life. And about the most consistent was like from 07, I'd say, 08, when I got married the first time. But even then, my buddy and I, we'd get all spun out, and we'd go down to the local rope club. We'd go down there until 2, 3, 4 o'clock in the morning, and just in time to go put horses away, get in the crew car, and go back for the rig.
So in that time when you were working in the oil patch, you were still involved with horses and you're roping and stuff?
Yeah. And I won the only saddle I ever won. I don't think I really won it. I out-entered them. I didn't out-rope them. I just out-entered them.
Yeah. You can do those at some of those jackpots, right?
Yeah.
Enter as many times as you want.
Well, on them deals, like you almost had to get to draw your good partners.
Yeah.
And get it where you can put something together and make something happen.
So you're still interested in the horses and shoeing, and even when you were working in the oil patch?
Yeah, not so much the shoeing deal. Just my own.
Yeah. But you're still doing your own had some horses during that time.
Oh, yeah. And if somebody needed some help chewing one, I'd help them. And sometimes I'd go back to LaBarge. There's a place next to the man that I grew up working for. It was the Fox Ranch. And the guy running that, we'd go then do some naughty stuff. And I'd go up there and we'd dip our toes in the fast water there, and then we'd go cowboy all week.
On your days off.
And like it was set up like, so during these weeks, if you're off during this time, come turnout time, come up all the horse riding you want. And I broke a couple horses up there. We'd go up there and brand and rope and move cows and gather and do that deal. And then we'd stuff them square bales in the back of the truck behind the trailer behind the horses. And away we'd go back to Vernal, Utah.
So you were getting to do some cowboy stuff while you were working in the patch. You mentioned your first wife. Where did you meet her at?
On the face page.
Oh, on Facebook.
Well, and she was from Vernal, and we done a bunch of roping and stuff. She'd come to some ropings and whatever. She was actually living in Shelley, Idaho when we got together, but she was coming back and forth to Vernal quite a bit to rope and what have you, and that's where she grew up, and her dad was the Rattler rope guy when it used to be in Vernal, Utah.
Oh, yeah.
And then he was the production manager for Geisler's over there in Idaho Falls for 7 or 8 years. I don't know which, but.
How long did you guys date before you got married?
Not very long.
And you were still working in the oil patch?
Oh, yeah.
So you were making money, roping.
Lots of it. I had a little 5-acre place with a house and 5-stall horse barn. And we had 5 or 6 head of rope horses.
And she moved to Wyoming?
Yes. No, she moved back to Vernal when we got together.
Oh, you had your place in Vernal there?
And I had a little girl, and she had a little girl and a little boy. And it was a pretty tough situation, but we liked to do too much drinking and partying, and that's what got us in trouble.
Yeah, marriage is hard enough when you're sober, right? It's like I get why things blow up when you're drinking and doing other things.
And I love to go fast. Especially being in the Roughneck deal, it was a wide open or broken deal.
Oh, yeah, man. You guys work hard. Play hard.
Always going fast.
So how long were you guys married?
Not for too long, about just over a year or so, and didn't work out, and she found her new boyfriend, and I'd fell off the deep end, and I had confrontations, and I have a daughter, and I haven't been a very good parent to her, and up to that point, well, I was going to try to get some custody of her or whatever, and then some things happened and whatever. Her mother told me, I know how this system works, you motherfucker. I'll get what I want. And I'll be damned if she didn't, because the next thing I know, I'm being arrested for child molestation. And then it comes to a head.
What?
Yeah, the day before my 25th birthday or 26th birthday.
So your daughter's mother made these allegations against you.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
And about that time, my wife, she'd been seeing one of our friends or whatever, and they're married now, and they have a little girl, and I'm so happy that they're doing good together. Mm-hmm. And that's the good part that came out of it, is she took, even though the situation was wrong, and I was in the wrong myself or whatever, and I've been doing some dope, and I told her I'd been off of it or whatever, and I went out of town to work in Nevada for a little while and did some more dope down there and whatever, and kind of ruined that whole deal. And during that time, we had to bury her little girl as well.
Man, I can't even imagine. All this is happening at once.
Yes, all of it. And the rig I've been working on, they stacked the rigs out and we got all cut loose, like fired and laid off or whatever. And some of them, they just moved to a different rig and I didn't get moved to another rig because I was a problem. They'd blackballed me from True before because I got in a fist fight with the company hand out on the location. Well, it wasn't even on the location. It was at the bar over something that happened on location. And they said that I was taking work in, that they said that I was a supervisor in a supervisor's position being a driller, and that I represented their company and on and off, even when I was on time off.
Yeah. So here you are. Your wife is hooking up with your buddy. She lost a daughter. You essentially, someone that you cared about, obviously, that little girl. And your daughter's mother made allegations against you.
It was all within like a 3-month span.
And you lost
3-week span.
And you lost your job.
And my career, 8 years, and put me over the edge. And I was in jail, and they didn't take my cell phone from me. So I called and I got hold of my father, and he was the tool pusher down there on the rig I was working on, or the neighboring one, back and forth between the two. And anyways, so I got bailed out of jail and I never said anything to him. Never nothing. I walked right past him, went to my pickup, got my pistol, drove out behind Vernal, Utah, at Steinaker Reservoir. And I tried to end my life with that pistol. Shot myself in the head with a .357. And some mountain bike rider found me down there. I guess I got out of the back of my pickup and was walking around. And he sees me out there bleeding out of the head, and he called the ambulance on me and got me contained or whatever. And they air-flied me to Salt Lake City. And I don't know how long I spent down there in that deal, but I had to have a couple of craniotomies. Once to get all the junk out, and then once to try to rebuild the dome.
You really shouldn't even be here, right?
No. They told my mama a couple times that he's not going to be nothing. You want to keep him alive? And she was praying. And this is the thing I remember. My first remembering thought was opening my eyes. And I must have heard her say, no, not yet. And because that's the first thing I remember. No, not yet. He still got life in him. And I opened my eyes like right then. I guess. Because that's the first memory that I have of after that situation.
So your dad bails you out. You don't even look at him. You made up your mind the only way out of this was to end it.
Because it'd be so much better for everybody else. Well, maybe it's best. I just won't be here. Then there'll be no problems for anybody else. All the stuff that I've created or whatever can be gone, and I will be too. And that'll be that. And I don't know. I was scared shitless, though.
I don't even. I've been to the edge of that. I've had a gun in my mouth, and I had 3 in the chamber, and I spun it, and click. and I've shared this before, I don't know if on here, but I remember being relieved and mad at the same time when it clicked. Relieved that it didn't go off and mad that it didn't go off at the same time. But I say that just like I felt the same thing. I made an account of everyone in my life that I'd messed up their life. And the net result of that was everyone would be better without me. Right?
It's the only logical option, isn't it? If you got a bad apple and a whole bushel of them, do you throw all the other apples away just because this one still has half of it that's okay? No, you get rid of that apple and then use the rest of them for whatever you're going to make. Cannon, pies, whatever.
Something good.
And they're useful.
Yeah. So you drive down to this lake or wherever and make this choice, like right after you got out of jail. You drove straight there.
Yeah, within 10 minutes, maybe.
And then how long till this mountain biker found you, saw you? You don't know?
Nope.
Because you don't, do you remember anything?
I remember trying to get up and walk around or something, and I remember getting mugged down by the police or the ambulance or somebody at the hospital. And the rest is kind of a dream, I guess.
How long were you till you remember what you just shared about your mom saying there's life still left in him? How long between the time when you pulled the trigger to that first memory? How long was that time in between those two things?
I don't know that exact time frame. It was a couple of weeks, I'm sure.
So you were in a coma?
Yeah.
On life support?
The whole deal, I'm sure, life support and breathing tubes and feeding tubes and
keeping your heart going. I mean, geez. What do you remember your first thoughts when you kind of came to in that moment?
No, I don't totally remember it.
What let me rephrase it. What are the first clear thoughts you remember?
I got to get up and I got to get out of here.
I got to run.
And I think I tried to get up then too, and I couldn't walk. I didn't know how to walk no more.
And your mom was there?
Yeah, I think they had to tie me down, I think. Because I kept trying to get up and take off, and I couldn't walk.
Just knew you didn't want to be.
Yeah. Didn't want to be in that hospital no more.
How long after that were you still in the hospital?
I don't know. They locked me up in the psychiatric place, make sure I wasn't going to turn on somebody else, I guess. And the thing that was there is, like, I always had a foundation. Like, I believed in a higher power. I believed in God, but I had no relationship with him at all. I had a little bit of Mormon background because my friends growing up, one of my best friends, we'd go horn hunting, ride horses and stuff and whatever. He lived on a ranch, and the only way I could come out to their house and play with him was if I went to church with him to the Mormon church the next day. Well, I liked playing with him, so it was a fair trade.
Sure. Makes sense.
And then when I was locked up in the psychiatric unit at the University of Utah, what did they have there? Well, they had the Bible, King James Version, and the Book of Mormon. I picked them up and started reading them. Real slow. And I guess that's where I gained a testimony of Jesus Christ, but I don't know. I know that he's real, and I know that he saved me, and I'm so thankful for it.
Was it in that time when you were in there that do you feel like your life as you knew it could be redeemed? Did you think maybe God saved me for a reason? I'm alive for a reason. Were you thinking any of those kind of thoughts?
Not at the time, but I do think that the good Lord saved me for a reason. But I also often come back and think that maybe he was just showing the example of what it looks like to be a dipshit all the time. I don't know. I sure can't seem to get my stuff together.
Well, it's when I, that's why it's called the narrow path, the journey, we call it, right? Because it's not somewhere you ever arrive at. And from the 28-year-old version of you to this version of you, I would suggest that you've come a long way.
26.
Okay.
Yeah, that situation took place in 2009 on July 27th. My birthday's on July 28th.
So when you were in the hospital, do you know how long you were in there at all? Were you in there 6 months or?
Well, more than a year, because I went in at 25 and I came out at 26.
Oh, you were in the hospital for over a year.
Well, I don't think, not physical time, but I turned a year older in there.
Yeah. So you were in there for a long time.
Just a couple, 3 months, 3 or 4 months though, from then till like October.
Just doing like all the rehabilitation stuff.
Oh yeah. I had to learn how to walk again and everything.
Like what about your motor skills? Could you like write and all that, or do you have to learn all that over?
I had to learn a bunch of it over.
Did you lose much of like your memory?
Quite a bit of it, but I still remember like a lot of stuff that happened when I was young. But like my short-term memory, a lot of it's gone.
Still.
Yeah. And like processing everything, the whole right frontal lobe is what got in the bullet's way. It was the deflector, I guess.
So while you're in there, you're reading the Bible, reading the Book of Mormon, and I would imagine that as I know you today, God's speaking to you through his word, because where did your hope come from? Because were you still in a lot of legal trouble?
Oh yeah. I was in legal trouble and the whole deal, and I had to go down to the funny farm down there at Provo, Utah for a 90-day evaluation. And then buggers cut me locked in there for 114 days.
Dang. Just to see.
I think that's worse than jail.
Yeah, I would imagine so. What was that like? What do they do to you in there? Just evaluate you?
Yeah, like they put you like through these little classes and have reading time, music, like see where you are on a cognitive level and a social level. And
was it to see if you were like fit for trial or something?
Yeah. Competence. So like, it's like going through school. Like they put you through all kinds of tests. See if you can read, write, understand, comprehend, whatever, all that stuff. Make sure I wasn't a danger to myself or society.
So that was after you got out of the hospital?
Yes.
You went straight there. What did they determine?
Well, the truth come out, and here I am today when all the truth finally come all out in the courts and in the deal. And
so you had to go to trial. You had to go to court.
Yep.
And your daughter's mom, they figured out that she was lying.
Well, they figured out that she was lying because none of them matched up. So it never even went to the final trials. They intern, he's like, you sure you want to go down through this? He asking the prosecutor and all this, you sure you want to do this? He says, you can save face and call it insufficient or whatever and whatever. We can take care of the whole thing. And they said, well, so it ended up not going to the trials because nothing would match up for him. Everything was his whole cross deal or whatever. Nothing was working out for the real story. The truth come out that it was all a bunch of hogwash and that she was playing the system.
Hmm. So when you got out of being evaluated for 120 days, then you went to the court stuff, then they just turned you loose. They're like, okay, I guess you're ready to go back into society.
Yeah, well, I don't know what else they could do to me.
Yeah.
They couldn't keep me there. They said that I could comprehend enough to go to a trial if there was one and whatnot, and what else they can do.
So then what?
Because it's not illegal to shoot yourself.
Right. Yeah, there's no ticket, I guess.
As long as I wasn't a harm to society. Yes, I don't know how all that stuff works. I try not to pay attention because it just makes me think about stuff and I get angry. And
yeah. Well, we can move past it. What did you do after that, though? Did you go back to Wyoming?
Mm-hmm. I went back to Wyoming when I got out of the hospital and all that.
To your mom?
All the smoke cleared.
To your mom's place?
Yeah, and went back to work for the same man I grew up working for.
On the ranch?
Steve Hoffman. He's probably one of my favorite people.
Took you right back.
You know, I didn't do him right either, I don't think, or I'd probably still be there. But, and as we went, like that same man who wouldn't let me play with his kid unless I went to church with him, he come to my house. And he took me in, and he had a ranch as well, and he used me for work and all this stuff, and he helped me out a lot. He helped me get a pickup again, and he helped me do. He's just a good man. And I didn't stay with the Mormon religion after I'd met my current wife, and we kind of assessed things from our own perspectives and our own thoughts, feelings, and whatever. And we didn't stay with the LDS religion, but I can say that LDS people, they are some of them are very, very godly and some of them aren't. Just as the same as any religion.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I would agree with that.
And whether I think it's the way that I need to travel or not, it's kind of here or there, but there's some LDS people that dang sure have the Spirit of the Lord with them, without a doubt.
Yeah, a lot of my best friends and roping partners are LDS, and I love them. They're great human beings.
Absolutely. But no, that man, he helped me out a bunch, and I just stayed around there cowboy, and then I went and worked over in Farson, Wyoming for a little while and moved around, and I thought, well, there's more cows in Fremont County than anywhere in the state of Wyoming. That's where I'm going to go. I've been there for the last 10 years now, I guess.
When did you meet your now wife?
Oh, about 5 years ago.
In
6 years Riverton? Ago. In Lander, Wyoming. She was working at the post office in Lander, and I went in there to mail some stuff, and she helped me, and she's a beautiful redheaded woman, and I asked her if she wanted to go for a drive one day, and we did, and they got this little place called Loop Road over there. Goes up through the mountains and comes back down South Pass Highway, and so we went on that Loop Road, and then we just started hanging out a little bit more and a little bit more. The more we hung out, the more we liked each other. And then we got together and we ended up buying a home. And before we got married, but we'd planned to be married before we was engaged to be married before we bought our house. And I quit working on the reservation for this man. I worked out on the reservation over there in Ethity for 5 years. between Lander, Ethony, and Fort Washakie there. And I never had any trouble with those Indians. Oh, I ended up living in this house once in a while. It was kind of a party house before I moved into it. And sometimes I'd wake up and there'd be one or two of them sleeping on the porch. Or stop in and ask you for a ride. Or money. But I didn't mess with them. I didn't yell and cuss them out. I'd say, well, you can't stay here. So-and-so don't live here no more. You're going to have to go on somewhere else. He lives right down there, and I'd kind of point towards his house. And, or whatever, but I didn't have any trouble. And so I kind of found out, it's just like every other people. Like, if you don't mess with them and get in their business and start prying on what they're doing, they're not going to get in your business and start prying on what you're doing.
No. What, I'm kind of jumping back a little bit. When you got out of the hospital and all of that, what was your stance on like drugs and alcohol after that?
Oh, I didn't do them. Because I was going to be a perfect good Mormon boy and not do anything wrong, not even swear or nothing. And boy, that didn't work out for that long. Some things a guy just can't do. And swearing for me is one of them.
Well, I mean, it's probably better than crystal meth, right?
Yeah, I suppose.
So you've been sober since the incident.
Yes, sir. But you want to know the odd thing about all that stuff? Is the whole time I was doing drugs and partying, I didn't y'all think try blowing my head off. But when I stopped and sobered up,
I've been sober for like 5 days before I played Russian roulette, because when you're anesthetizing your pain, there's no reason to put a gun in your mouth, right? Because you're not feeling the pain. It's when you go to jail and have time to think about things, that's when it all hits. I have a really weird theology about this that is going to ruffle a lot of people's feathers, but I think that I got sober at the exact perfect time. I think God let me go on the journey of alcoholism because it saved my life. If I would have tried to deal with my childhood and pain and all of that before I had a wife and a daughter and a son, I wouldn't have made it. I think that alcohol, in some weird way, saved my life.
I can go with that 100% because same deal. Like, and this, I don't hold people that are going through an addictive situation like that, because I know what it feels like to be like, that's the only thing that you can do to live in your own skin.
Yeah.
So I totally understand it. Like, it's either that or the alternative. What is it? What are you going to pick? So I try not to hold anybody against that. Like, I totally understand where they're coming from, because I've been in that position. Like, without it, I mean, that was the only thing that was keeping me going from one day to the next, which is sad to say that the only thing that could keep, that was keeping you going, was the use of crystal meth. But I mean, all in all, I couldn't live in my own skin and look myself in the mirror without being.
Yeah. Self-hatred's a powerful emotion. That's why this conversation's so important, because we now know that you can get better without trying to kill yourself and stop addictive reasons why we do the things we do, right? Because there is hope, there is a way, there is help, there are paths that you can take to not anesthetize your pain because you don't want to be in your own skin any longer. And the thought of getting through the day sober is so freaking scary. And I know that, and you know that. But I also know that there is a way out of it. There is a way to get better. And there is a way for God to redeem your story and redeem your life without taking your own life or anesthetizing your pain. And it's scary. You got to face it and deal with it and get some help, right? To have someone help you walk through it, because I couldn't do it without all the people that have helped me in this journey.
You know, I'm with you on that 100%. That deal, I mean, it's such a demand. I mean, it becomes a mental block and a physical block and everything. But at the same time, I mean, what are you going to do? You can't just keep doing it. You got to figure out something. And it's a tough golden hill to climb for sure.
It is hard and it's scary but it's possible. Cause we're both living proof of it, sitting here talking today. Like there are, especially your story, bro, like it's a miracle. You're a walking miracle.
Yeah, I'll agree with that too. I don't know why the Savior decided that I needed to be sitting here across from you today, but it's all part of it, I suppose.
Yeah, because somebody potentially could be listening to this that feels much of the same ways that you and I have felt prior to, let's call it, our redemption trail, our redemption road that we're on now, that needs to hear your story. Because there is hope. Because you and I felt hopeless, and it gets to the place to where we do all the math, right? We're like, this person, that person, this, everybody would be better off without me. And that's not the truth. It's not the truth. Because God can turn our mess, right, into something beautiful. It's beauty for ashes. And that is, what if we could go give hope to somebody that's felt some of the same things that we've been through and felt, which is what this is all about.
And it sure is. I know I've had a lot of hope from it, and I know, like, it. Like, I guess what helped me too is when I get determined about something, I can usually get it taken care of. But like my whole life, all my teachers and everything told me I was just going to be a piece of crap. No, nothing. The world didn't need more cowboys. The world didn't need this. Didn't need that. They didn't need guys like me. So I guess when it come down to squeezing the trigger, that helped make it a little bit easier. And I don't know what the deal was, but I can tell you that sometimes, even still, even though we made it through this and we understand these things, sometimes it's like, on that day, why didn't it just work? Why wasn't I a better aim? And I've had those thoughts go through my mind several times after. Like, man, I survived that, and how come I can't get past this now? Or something. Or why didn't he just let me go when he had the opportunity? I mean, the timing was there.
Well, he clearly had a different vision for your life than you had for your own life.
I wish I could get a little bit of sight what it's supposed to look like.
I think it's looking like this.
Is it?
You're a powerful dude, man. When you came to the retreat last spring in Jackson Hole, and on that Sunday morning before we all left, you kind of shared some things. And to me, you sharing was the most impactful part of that whole weekend for me. Like, I think sometimes we all get in our heads and think, what is this all about? What is this life for? And I think that to be redeemed, to be saved, to be in restoration, the process of restoration of our souls, of our emotions, of our being, of our all of it, is not just for us, right? It's like, what impact can we make on the people around us and the people that we come in contact with? Like, what if that's enough? What if that's why?
Well, hopefully one day I'll be able to look the Savior in the eye and he says, "Well done, thy faithful servant." And reaches me his right hand.
I think he's going to give you a hug. I don't think he's going to shake your hand.
Well, I can hope, but all I know is this program that you established here, it's super cool for me because it lets me get among my peers. The guys that I see, maybe we don't have constant contact daily or whatever, but I see guys that's kind of living the same type of life I am, that, likes the horse and cowboy out deal and whatever, and being in the mountains or whatever. And it's nice to see, he might live over here in Idaho, but we get together at these times of fire, and he shares, and you're like, "Man, I've been having that same problem," and now we can put it together, whether it's the seasons or what. And he says, I've kind of went through this, and this helped navigate these feelings for me, and it gives a guy a different avenue. Like, "Oh, well, that didn't quite work, so we'll try this. We're on this avenue. Well, that, and maybe that'll help get me out of this, the way I'm feeling right now, or maybe the way I navigate some can help another guy." And like, it lets you know that these guys have some problems too, and if you listen to what they're doing, maybe you can apply it to yourself. And I like the part about that there's no teaching, preaching, or advice. Just your own experience. I really enjoy that because I went to counselors and that and stuff, and it seems like they always point you from the pastors or whatever that you share with or whatever. And counselors, they always point their finger at you like, "You need to do this and you need to do that." And that's a complete turnoff for me. Like, I've been hollered at and had their fingers pointed at me or whatever, shook at me my whole life. And I ain't really into that deal. But if I can just go listen to somebody else, and maybe he did, and I trained quite a few horses and tried to make a little bit of living that way. And it works with my horsemanship too. Like, "Well, that's not really working. Wonder about this." Maybe we try a little different perspective, or a little, how much pressure, the amount, or whatever, and let them kind of work through their own deal too. And it kind of helps. And I think that's that wild courage. It helps. It lets you see different avenues that you can go towards. Like, "Hey, that idea kind of fits my lifestyle." And you just kind of start veering over there. And it works, and or it doesn't work. One of the two. Maybe what you're doing can help another guy, and it just incorporates people, and men especially. Because especially for me, like, even sitting down here and talking to you, Jeremy, I mean, I was as nervous as a wolf shit in peach seeds.
It's just two dudes sitting in a barn.
But either way, I mean, to tell about your story and your shortcomings and being a piss poor dad. I was a piss poor dad. And part of it is, and my girl, she's 17 now. And, but part of it is after all that business, like I've worked to rebuild my own life. How could I love my little girl when I couldn't love my own self? And she don't understand that all she sees really is what I wasn't. Not that she doesn't see the obstacles and the hills and the jungles I had to traverse to get to overcome that, to even be able to survive myself in the world. And I'm so, like, it bothers me so much that I wasn't able to be there for her. And now it's, I feel like it's too late because she don't want nothing to do with me. She won't talk to me. She won't respond to me, nothing. And it breaks my heart, but I don't know what to do besides just keep trying to encourage her to do well, and hopefully it'll come through.
Yeah, that's a tricky one. You know, I have a 25-year-old daughter who I wasn't around for either. And now we have a really beautiful relationship. I say that as hope-giving because I wasn't a good dad. I wasn't around. I was a drunk. She lived in Montana. I lived everywhere else but where she lived, and was on the run from the same thing you said. Like, I couldn't even manage my own checkbook. How could I be a dad, right? Literally. And if I had a check, it would bounce. You know what I mean? Like, that is a snapshot of the train wreck that my life was. And I'm really grateful for my mom and my now wife and my sister and my brother-in-law and my nieces who stayed close to her when I was not available to be with her. And now we're on the repair journey. And I'm saying all this to you that it's not too late. It's not too late. And especially at 17, like, there'll be a time when I think you'll have the opportunity to begin to repair that broken relationship. Because God designed us all to be, want to have some connection with where we came, who we came from, right? And that's probably, as an adult, that strained relationship with a child, there's probably nothing more painful than that. But I just want to give you hope that it's not too late, brother. It's not.
I'm going to take that. I'm going to keep that with me.
But you said it earlier, like I say on here all the time, you can't give away what you don't have. So having grace for yourself, and like, I couldn't even manage my own being in my own skin. That's why we got to stay on this journey, because even the Bible says, love your neighbors, you love yourself. If you don't love yourself, how can you love your neighbor? How can you love your daughter? How can you love your spouse? How can you love, you know what I'm saying? Like, that's why this narrow path that we talk about, this journey, is so important, is that we go find out who we were created to be and what our purpose is, and that God has a plan and a purpose for our life, and we go pursue that and get healthy and whole, right? And then we have something to offer people around us. We have love and compassion for ourselves and our story and all the messes we've made, and also grace and compassion for the man that we're trying to become on this narrow path, and we're trying to find our way, and we're traversing these mountains, like you said. Like, bro, keep going. Because as you find that in yourself, then it gives you the capacity to have more to give away.
And I don't know, and also part of it that she don't understand is the things that her mother said about me was lies, and when they came to fruition, then she didn't want to be looking like it was a bunch of BS, so she had to keep playing it all the way through. And like, all they wanted to get out of me was any money they could come up which was none.
But
and you said something that you were thankful for your mom, and I'm thankful for my mother. My mother kept a relationship, and at times it would really anger me. Even when my father and stepmother would do that, they kept a relationship with them too. And
oh,
it made me so angry.
Yeah.
Like you sons of bucks. Why, what the hell?
No, be grateful.
Well, I see how it is. You pick them over me.
Yeah.
You bet. And like my father and I, we aren't talking about it over to each other over these things right now, over that same very deal.
I would challenge you to be really, really grateful that there's a tie back to you through your family. That's what kept my relationship with my daughter alive in the years when I was not available to her at any capacity. It was my mom and my now wife and my sister and my brother-in-law who would fix her car and do all the things I was supposed to do. You know what I mean? So I just would challenge you to be grateful for that and to look at it from this different perspective of that's your tie back to her. And I get that it hurts because you want to be in that position with them, with her, that they are. And that totally makes sense. But
maybe that's why I'm jealous too, is because I'm angry at him.
Yeah.
I'm angry over it. Like, what the hell? She just calls you, and here I try everything I can think of under the sun, and she won't give me the time of day.
Well, you also, it would help maybe to put yourself in her shoes a little bit.
Well, I try to.
And see what her experience has been like. And like, I get it, but I'm also, you know, I would just, again, encourage you to keep going, man. And it's not too late. It's not too late for God to redeem your relationship with your daughter and for it to start off slowly, you know, as she feels safe. And it gives me hope that your mom and your dad are still in relationship with her for sure.
And that same deal, but that, it does give me hope. And that's another deal why I appreciate this program. Well, because I've heard very many stories from across the map, not just everywhere across the map, but even in my local community, at our local deals in Pavilion, Wyoming, Riverton, whatever little town that it's under right now, but I hear several of these same types of situations about how their lives and with their children were kind of, I'm sure they weren't quite too extreme as mine is, but either way, that it was a struggle and a poor relationship, no matter what the severity or the level was, a poor relationship rekindled into a beautiful flower now.
Yeah. Yeah, there's hope. Well, man, I wish that you could see you the way I do. And I know the way that the Father experiences you, because I think you are extremely powerful and you have a lot to say. And I find you, Ben Balow and I were talking about you this morning, actually. We were on the phone. And I describe you as someone who I think is very intelligent and articulate and well thought out. And I like to hear what you have to say. And I don't think I'm the only one that feels that way. And so I'm just really grateful for not only our friendship, but for you being in the journey and trying to figure things out. And I feel like a lot of guys who have been through maybe some of the stuff you've been through would be like, this is enough. I'm just going to start sweeping everything under the rug. And what I see is a man who's continually saying yes to the journey. You're still trying to be a better man. You're still trying to be a better husband. You're still trying to show up for your friends as the best version of yourself. And that humility I'm drawn to. And I'm just, as much as one man can say to another man, I'm like really proud of you. And I'm glad that you're in my life. And I'm really grateful for you and your story. And keep going, man. You're making a difference. You're making a difference.
Yeah, and you mentioned Ben Balow, and that's a man that I met at this Wild Courage Retreat here at Moran in the last year. And it, what a wonderful person he has turned out to be, like a cornerstone of my life. He sends me some texts, and they're life savers. Like, I don't know if it's the season that, like, it's the text that he sends us lines up perfect with the season that I'm in or something or that I'm going through. So a lot of times, like, holy smokes, where did you come up with that?
He's that guy to a lot of us. He's amazing. And you're worthy of friends like this is my other point. You know what I mean? You're a worthy man. You're worthy to have good men in your corner and around you that are for you. I'd hope that you remember that.
And Grant Gallagher is out there too. What a wonderful man that guy is. What a blessing he's been to me in every aspect that we've come in contact.
Yeah, he's another one that thinks a lot of you. He said you're a good horseshoer too. He would know.
He is a smart man. If, I guess if he says it, it's got to be true. Yeah. I wished I could retain some of the knowledge that he's presented for me.
Well, the two guys we're just talking about are like two of my biggest mentors. You know what I mean? Like in and outside of horses and sobriety and spirituality. And those are two solid dudes that if you know those two guys and they care about you, that means you're heading in the right direction for sure.
Yeah, I hope. I got plans to go down to Ben Balow's part of the country here and build a saddle with another friend of mine. And I'd sure like to go and hang out with Ben a little bit.
Yeah, you need to go ride with him. You'll learn a lot for sure.
Definitely. I'm excited about that.
Well, brother, again, unless there's any parting things you'd like to say, I just want to thank you for jumping out of your way to come spend some time with me in the barn and share your incredible story of some of the heartache you've been through. I'm sure we could have spent 10 hours sitting here unpacking a bunch of it, but thank you so much. I know this wasn't easy for you, and I really appreciate it.
And I appreciate you having me, Jeremy, and I don't know if Blaine Tolman is going to listen to this, but if he's out there, I'd like to thank him as well. He's done a lot for me just, and he's never really asked for any, he's never like said, you got to do this or you got to do that. Or you remember when I did this for you? Like he's never said any of that. He's just
for the right
out of the goodness of his heart. And because he wanted to see me be better, he's done a lot for me. And I'm grateful to have people come into my life like that. And there's a pile of other ones that I probably ain't going to be able to get them all off right now, but there's a pile of people that's helped Matt Zupanik down the road of life, and I'm very grateful for them. And
that's what this brotherhood's all about, right? Is if, like we were talking about earlier, like what if we could go get healthy enough that we could help the guy that needs it, that's coming up behind us?
Even you know? One. Even one.
Just one. Says. Yep.
Even one, if we can help one. Just imagine what it'd be if we could help many.
Yep.
I mean, if we help one, we've done what we're asked of. If we help many, it's just the icing on the cake.
That's right. That's right. Well, again, Matt, thank you again for sharing your story and taking some time. And I look forward to our growing friendship and going to Brandon with you at some point. That'd be fun.
Yeah, definitely.
Right on. All right, guys. Thanks. Adios for now.